Okay. Well, I want to talk this morning about the decline and rise of the concept of the just war. When I say decline and rise, that's more a hope than a statement of fact. I would like to see it decline and then rise in a new and very modified form. Doing my homework, I looked in the Confessions of the Lutheran Church. There I find that Article 16 of the Augsburg Confession says, "Of civil affairs we teach that it is right for Christians to bear civil office, to sit as judges, and so forth, and to engage in just wars." The apology to the Augsburg Confession in Article 16 goes into a great more detail, very interesting detail, by the way. You might read it sometime. But all I want to focus on now is the concept of a just war. If we teach that it is right for Christians to engage in just wars, we obviously think there is such a creature as a just war. But is there? It is very doubtful. I think that the best arguments against the concept of the just war have usually been created by its friends. In trying to define a just war, they have shown up the poverty of the concept. Almost inevitably, attempts to define a just war have gone at it through the concepts of guilt and innocence. And right here, the basic trouble arises. Guilt and innocence are ideas which just don't fit very well the actions of nations. Guilt and innocence, these are concepts that we can apply with sense to the actions of individuals. But when we try to apply them to the actions of collectivities, like nations, we almost inevitably involve ourselves in some kind of contradiction. Take some specific examples. Who is the guilty nation when a war breaks out? Well, we like to say the aggressor is the guilty nation. Okay, but who's the aggressor? He who struck first? Well, but what if the country that struck first struck in order to avoid a strike by another nation? How long do you have to, if you see somebody winding up his fist and about to hit you in the teeth, are you the aggressor if you kick him in the ribs? Or what if the nation that struck first struck in order to remedy the consequences of some past aggression? Then who's the aggressor? Moreover, aggression takes on a myriad of disguises. Aggression can run from blatant to extremely subtle. Blatant aggression is an infantry assault. But subtle aggression might be a blockade, or a veiled threat, or a little espionage. Where do guilt and innocence lie between Israel and the Arab nations? Who is guilty and who is innocent between India and Pakistan when it comes to the issue of Kashmir? Where do guilt and innocence lie in Vietnam? There has, I think, never been a war in which each country involved could not honestly claim that it was in the right. Because when nations go to war, they are risking a great deal. They are inflicting a huge cost upon themselves. You may say, well, no, the rulers sit up there and they just send off the masses of the people. But the ruler always threatens his own authority when he does this. Because if he loses, he may cease to be ruler. A war is dangerous for a nation. The nation will not engage in war unless it believes that its cause is just. And that's why I feel reasonably safe in asserting that in every war that has ever been fought, all of the participants honestly believed that they were fighting a just war. Well, now, in a situation such as this, the attempt to assess degrees of guilt and innocence just turns out to be empty logic chopping, question begging at best, self-righteousness and hypocrisy at worst. Okay. A lot of people in our time have begun to think like this, have begun to say things like I've been saying. The growth of cosmopolitanism, of cultural relativism, increasing knowledge on the part of many people of the way other people live, of their cultures. The increased habit, I think it is an increased habit, of looking skeptically upon one's own moral claims, something that maybe we learned from Sigmund Freud, I don't know, plus a host of other factors have undermined in our time the concept of just war. At least these factors have undermined it for sensitive and educated people. I think most sensitive and educated people in our culture see just war as a big hypocrisy. They don't argue, they just laugh when somebody says that a particular war is just. Now, I'm not denying, of course, that the mass of people go on believing in a just war. But for them, a just war is whatever war our nation happens to be engaged in at the moment. Now, the problem arises here, though. If there is no such thing as a just war, then it seems that we ought all to be pacifists if we're consistent. But pacifism is not an easy position to hold, at least without gross inconsistency. And not very many people do, in fact, hold it. From which it follows that there must, after all, be some such creature as a just war. Let me put it less paradoxically. If our logic, which rejects the notion of a just war, does not also compel us to adopt the pacifist position, all war is wrong, war should never be fought, or a Christian cannot engage in war or contribute to his nation's war effort. If our logic does not compel us to adopt that position, then we are somehow or the other granting the possibility of a justifiable war. And this is what I want to explore, the concept of justifiable war. Under what circumstances is war justifiable? I'm going to conclude that there is, and I'll just conclude it now and we'll see what it means, that there is today an urgent need to resurrect the concept of the just war, but in the humbler guise of the justifiable war. I want to bury the concept of war as ever a good thing, a righteous thing. And you see, that's implicit in the adjective just. You know, a just war is something in which all just men, all righteous men, all moral men will participate enthusiastically. I want to bury that. That is an abominable notion. But I want to restore what I think is a vital notion, the notion of war as necessary evil. Now, there are some people I know who will object. They'll say, war needs no justification at all. And they're right. War does not need justification. What it does need is limitation. And that is what the concept of the justifiable war may help to provide us, a way of limiting war. Okay, there's a slogan you've all heard, a little proverb, says, all's fair in love and war. Now, I don't think the love part is serious. But all's fair in war is a very important and true insight. This proverb gives us an important clue to the nature of war. War is conflict in the absence of law. Law means rules governing conduct with appropriate sanctions. Now, United Nations declarations are not law, because there are no effective sanctions. Resist not evil. This is not law either, for exactly the same reason. International law is mostly a misnomer. There ain't no such beast. It doesn't exist because sanctions don't exist. There is no way to decide the facts, apply the law, and make the decision of international law stick. Hence, there is no such thing as international law. All's fair in war because there is no law. And where there is no law to determine what is permissible and what is not, no law to enforce the rules of the game, anything goes. War, the fact of war, itself testifies to the absence of law. Well, now, some people say, well, why not then establish an international law? Why not bring the nations under the rule of law and thus abolish war? Well, that's a very fine idea, and I'm all for it. And I'm sure you are all for it. But can it be done? That's the problem. The lawgiver, now here's where I trespass on, I'm trespassing already, of course, on Bernd Riecke's territory. The lawgiver must be stronger than every prospective lawbreaker if the rule of law is to be established. Law gets obeyed as law because and insofar as it is in the interest of the law obeyer to do so. The crucial test of whether law exists, whether law is possible, whether there is a rule of law, comes, the crucial test comes when someone finds that the decision of law is contrary to his interest. In that moment, he must see that the power of the lawgiver, the power to punish him or reward him, that this power of the lawgiver is so great as to make it in his interest to obey the law despite the fact that he ardently wishes the law were different from what it is. I say that's the crucial test. The crucial test for what? For the possibility of the rule of law. that may strike you as a somewhat cynical statement. The crucial test for the possibility of the rule of law arises when someone says, I reject that decision of the law with every fiber of my being. He says, it's against my interest. I am deprived of my rights. This cannot be, he cries to high heaven. But the power of the lawgiver is so great that he must knuckle under. When that situation exists, when that test is met, that he does in fact knuckle under, then you've got the rule of law. Now, I don't want to exaggerate the role of naked force, the role of pure coercion, but I do want to make the point that the effectiveness of law rests ultimately on the power to coerce. Law only exists where decisions are enforceable. Now, the question that arises here is, why does law, in this sense, ordinarily exist within countries but not among countries? And the answer can be stated simply, though it's no simple answer. Within a nation, there exists a community of interest such that overwhelming power can be marshaled against anyone who continues to assert his particular interest contrary to the decision of law. A nation can almost be defined in terms of this community of interest. A community of interest, it's hard to describe. You have to be describing all kinds of, in terms of all kinds of intangibles and imponderables. Loyalty to certain abstract concepts, reverence to common symbols, an intuitive feeling that we're sort of all in this together, that that we're all one people, and so we've got to do what is in the interest of all of us. These are the things, I just summarize them in the phrase community of interest, which guarantee that when someone decides to resist the decision of law, overwhelming power will be marshaled against him and he will be forced to yield. Thus, I don't like the decision of the court. In some case, I go to court, property settlement maybe. I don't like it, but I must bow. The alternative we call revolution. But I cannot expect to mount a successful revolution on behalf of my claim that I was defrauded in a property settlement. It just isn't going to work. I can go out on the street and say, here is what this judge said. Look at the facts, he's wrong. Justice requires that I be given what he did not give me. And some people will listen. Most of them will dismiss me as a crank. And I will not be able to mount a successful revolution. Because I can't persuade enough other people that their interest is somehow being threatened by this failure to take account of my interest. Of course, now, think about this for a moment. If enough people identify with me and see my interest as their interest, then we might have a revolution. If, for example, I say, I'm a leader of a labor union, and we mount a strike, and the law hands down an injunction, says you may not do this. And I get up on the soapbox and I say, this is tyranny. If the law can do this to me, look what it can do to you. And the great mass of people agree that this is tyranny. They see that this threatens them. And they may then revolt. You do get revolutions. But when you get a revolution, by definition, the community of interest has ceased to exist. The revolution is a proof that there is no longer a real nation. In that moment, law ceases to be law, and we have war. Then we call it civil war. Civil war is really just like any other kind of war. The civilness of a war refers to the past. A war is a civil war not because it is fought within a nation, because the existence of war is proof that no nation exists. It's called a civil war because there once was a nation, and now there is not. The rule of law depends upon the existence of this community of interest that really defines a nation and creates the possibility of law. And when that is destroyed, because the community of interest is somehow eroded, then the possibility of war breaks out within a nation just as it continually exists among nations. A dramatic example of this sort of thing, in a way, maybe it's not too dramatic, is Prohibition. Now, in the 1920s, the nation did not disintegrate, but the Prohibition law was unenforceable. The reason that the nation didn't disintegrate was because we were somehow able to separate this law out from the rest of the law. And what we did was say, there was a sort of consensus that we will not take the same attitude toward the breakers of the Prohibition law that we take toward the breakers of other laws. We refused to invoke overwhelming force against violations of the Prohibition law because we felt, enough of us, that the communal interest was not seriously enough threatened by violations of the Volstead Act. And so the Prohibition law was largely not law. What it was more a pious or an impious hope. International law is today nothing but a pious hope, because there does not exist, however much we might wish it, there does not exist in our world a community of interest such that overwhelming power can be marshaled against any nation that continues to assert its particular interest contrary to a decision of the UN General Assembly or the World Court or whatever body is supposed to lay down decisions in international disputes. That community of interest doesn't exist. International law cannot create the one world of which so many of us dream. And it's a good dream. But international law can't create it. Rather, when one world comes into existence, when one community of interest is established, when the peoples of the world have far more in common than they have to divide them, then one world will create international law. The nation comes first, then comes the law. The law can't create the nation. But that day is obviously a long way off yet. And what are we going to do in the interim? People say, shall every conflict between nations be allowed to lead to war? Shall nations be allowed to destroy the world because they're unwilling to settle their disagreements without resort to war? You very often hear the matter put in that way, in a kind of desperation. But the questions, those questions that I just quoted, really prejudge the issue. It is important to notice that every international conflict of interest does not, in fact, lead to war. It's important to notice that nations, by and large, do settle their disagreements without resort to war. Suppose that, in the absence now of international law, each nation pursued its own interest with singleness of mind and careful calculation. Say you've got 127 nations in the world. Each one is a law unto itself. Each nation now pursues its own interest as its most intelligent people and its leaders see that interest. They pursue it with singleness of mind and with careful calculation, trying to make sure that everything they do really serves the national interest. You might say, ooh, what a horrible, selfish, conflict-ridden world that would be. But if you think that, you've thought too fast. This would not mean continual war. It would more likely mean almost no war. Given perfect knowledge and perfect rationality, there would be no war. Because war is itself, in itself, is contrary to the interest of the participants. I mean, war, as I said before, inflicts costs, serious costs, upon a nation that participates. It is a threat to the very existence of the nation. No nation wants war. It uses war as a means to an end. What it wants is the end. Now, if this were a world of perfect rationality and perfect knowledge, then disputes between nations, conflicts of interest that arise between nations, would be settled by assessing the relative power of the disputants without resort to an actual trial by arms. In other words, we would get the product of war without having to go through the war itself. Does that sound paradoxical or something? Most conflicts of interest among nations are settled roughly in this way. And by the way, so are most disputes among private persons. How do we settle disputes among ourselves? When your real interests are in conflict, we sit down and talk about it as rational, knowledgeable people, unless we get terribly emotional, and that's going to bring me to the concept of justifiable war. If we don't get terribly emotional, if we allow reason and knowledge to control, we sit down and say, well, what would happen if we fought it out to the arena of last resort, whatever that is? In our country, it probably means the courts of law. And then we settle on the basis of what we think would, what we figure would happen if we did fight it out. We settle on those terms without actually going through the fight. Think of a big boy and a little boy. They have conflicts of interest. They don't fight too often. Why? Because they settle their disputes on the basis of what would happen if they did fight. Now, you may think, boy, that means that the big boy is going to get everything. No, there are certain limits. There's a point beyond which the little boy, just his interest, he feels his interest so threatened that he will kick and bite and claw, and the big boy just doesn't have any interest in pushing him that far. And so they settle. We do manage to live together without engaging in actual physical violence because we settle even our most vital conflicts of interest by trying to reason it through to what would happen if we did fight it out. All right. War arises from conflicts of interest. That's one way of looking at it. But there's another way of looking at it, which I am now suggesting. That war arises out of ignorance and irrationality. War is a mistake. If that's so, it follows logically, and it's my main contention this morning, that the way to limit war in our world is to get the weapons of diplomacy, including war as one technique of diplomacy, into the hands of knowledgeable and rational men. That means men who will pursue the interests of the nations they represent or rule intelligently. Not morally, but intelligently. Not morally because there is no moral war, and there is no moral cause among nations. Intelligently. The only justifiable war is an intelligent war. That means a war that is fought with careful and realistic attention in every moment to the national interest. Such wars, when they break out, will be limited wars. They will be brief trials of strength. They will be probes and threats rather than headlong confrontations. Now, this may have struck you as excessively abstract. I'm through with the abstract part. I just want to maybe it struck you as just obvious. I want to briefly indicate some applications and then throw it open to objections and questions that may succeed in clarifying what I'm trying to say better than any further exposition on my part. If you review the history of the past half century, if you really read the history carefully, I think you will be forced to the conclusion that these last 50 years, these tragic years, in which the world has been brought repeatedly to the brink of catastrophe and on over the brink, that this is due to the fact that diplomacy has passed out of the hands of professionals into the hands of amateurs and demagogues. And as a consequence, the touchstone of national interest meticulously adhered to has been more and more abandoned in favor of ideologies. And so that you have some examples of ideologies, let me mention some. Socialism, the proletariat, freedom, democracy, and all the other deadly virtues. Communism is an ideology that has caused some nations to abandon the limiting principle of national interest in favor of world revolution, wars of national liberation, and similar incendiary goals. The United States' response has too often been a counter-ideology, self-determination of peoples, universal democracy, and so on. This is the way to blow up the world. War can be limited. It can be kept within bounds. It can be preserved as a technique of diplomacy and a check against tyranny only when nations employ war exclusively for the protection and assertion of national interest. Carefully, calmly, selfishly, realistically assessed. That's the kind of world we live in. The unjustifiable war, as it turns out, is not the unjust war, but the war that is fought in the name of justice. The only justifiable war is the carefully calculated war. The war in which, at every moment, the relationship between means and limited ends is carefully kept in view. The war fought in the name of morality, or freedom, or to make the world safe for democracy, or for the peoples of the world. This is the unjust war par excellence. That's the demonic war. Okay, plenty of time for...
My question is, how, in the light of mass media that we have today, can you have effective diplomacy? The Congress of the Enemy, 2 years, no reporters are demanded to give a daily release, they play bridge. This illustration is from Karl Barth. And if something comes out of it that has some relative strength for almost 100 years. Today, you've got to give... let the people in on every blow, and the whole thing is like an arena, and how did our guy do today, David and Goliath?
Yeah, and you can push it one step further. The people in governments are aware of this danger, the danger that by giving information to the reporters, they let diplomacy get out of their hands, and so they lie to the reporters. And then what do? We get indignant. We talk about the credibility gap. We must be grateful for the credibility gap. Let me assert this heresy flatly. When it comes to international diplomacy, it is the duty of our government to deceive us. Notice I said when it comes to international diplomacy. Because the government is here dealing in a realm where there is no law, where all is fair. And if the government tells us the truth, it's telling our enemy the truth. You can't fight a war that way. You can't carry on diplomacy that way. You try to do it that way and you're the lamb. And lambs just don't make it in a world of tigers. Yeah?
Can you give a few examples of nations not working in their own best interest? Are you thinking mainly of India during the Suez and Arab or Israeli crisis?
Yeah. India has been very prone to inject all sorts of irrelevant and inflammatory moral material into conflicts of interest. And this is most objectionable. And it is not true, as so many of our leading moral theologians have said, that we must listen to India because she speaks sort of with the voice of morality. We found out how moral India was. India was always running around legislating morality on the world stage until she decided that she wanted those little Portuguese colonies, until she decided that Pakistan was trespassing on her interest, until she found that China was coming over the Himalayas. Then all of a sudden, morality is abandoned. Now is the time to defend the national interest. But as soon as India isn't fighting, she goes back to her role of preacher.
Would you say, of course, now that Russia has not been working in their own best interest?
I think that Russia made some serious mistakes in terms of her national interest. She overextended herself several times. But by and large, Stalin was extremely shrewd. And I think you've got to concede that. He knew pretty well the national interest of Russia, and he pursued it diligently and ruthlessly. He was not stopped until people like George Kennan caused American foreign policy to adopt the same kind of technique. The policy of containment, where we said, despite, you know, that all the outcry in the United States from 1945 on about liberating these oppressed peoples of Eastern Europe. Now, George Kennan and others said the U.S. got to assess its interest here. What would we do with these countries if we did liberate them? We would send in troops at an enormous cost in life, our lives, their lives. We would set them free from Russian domination. And what would happen then? Who would rule them? We don't want to rule them. What are we going to do? We would turn them loose, and in many cases, within a few years, the communists would have taken over again and established links with Russia. The best policy was to recognize that Russia had gotten in there, partly through some of our failure to be shrewd, because Churchill wasn't listened to enough. Churchill was regarded as a cynic and for playing the old balance of power game. Roosevelt was listened to, I think, a little too much, and Churchill not enough, but better not pass these judgments. But anyhow, we did allow Russia to get in. Now, realism said, she's in there, let's just contain her. When we feel that our vital interests are being affected, then we'll fight back, but we'll wait and see. And what has happened is the U.S. and Russia have both pursued their own interests, is that we have found ways to accommodate our interests. And who would have predicted even 10 years ago, that Russia and the United States would be as peaceful toward one another as they are today. That this peaceful coexistence, if you want to call it that, is a consequence of the fact that Russia and the U.S. have both played the game of international diplomacy by the rules, which is, with singleness of mind, they have pursued the national interest. And that's why, of course, that's why the Chinese communists call them filthy revisionists. They've abandoned the ideology.
This is my reason for your question, because you stated that nations were not, and it appeared to me that the Western powers, working with Russia and Cuba, as an example of that, have worked in their own national interest, whereas the United States, in dealing with Asiatic powers, and the Asiatic powers in dealing with the West, have more or less followed what you have said, working in irrational China and Vietnam,
yeah. Now, the problem is enormously complicated by the fact that in the so-called uncommitted or underdeveloped nations of the world, you can use all kinds of names for them, it isn't clear where there are nations. And consequently, it isn't clear what the national interest requires or who represents the national interest. And for the United States to involve itself with some kind of messianic complex in all of these disputes is an extraordinarily dangerous thing. I'm not passing judgment on any particular United States intervention. I don't want to say boo about the Vietnam case, as it's extraordinarily complicated. But I will say this as a general principle, that we have to restrain ourselves. If somebody starts a little revolution, it is not necessary for us to look at it and say, is that a good revolution or is that a bad revolution? Is that a revolution for freedom and the dignity of man, or is that a revolution for communism and enslavement? The first question to ask is, what business is it of ours? What difference does it make to us what happens? And if it makes no difference to us, then it's none of our business. Then we ought not get involved. You can call that selfishness and callousness, if you will, but I call it admitting self-limitation, and it's the only way to limit war. Yeah, Dan?
You're just judging the two things that you said now. The conscientious objector is just stupid because he doesn't know what connection and interest is.
No, no. It's not the job of the conscientious objector to define and promote the national interest. The conscientious...
He can't make his decision on whether it's a just war or a moral war.
Yeah, well, I happen to believe very firmly, and so do a lot of other people who are sympathetic to the idea of conscientious objection, that we cannot tolerate conscientious objection to particular wars. I believe firmly, and I'd be willing to argue for this, that... we should retain the idea of the conscientious objector, but that we cannot allow a man to say, well, I'm not a conscientious objector, I don't object to all wars, I object to this particular war. We can't allow it for the very simple reason that no conscientious objector is in a position really to decide the merits of a particular war.
Coming back to what you said just a moment ago, if this is true, that I examine my interest, does this involve my interest? Well, let's push it just a little farther to a particular situation. Supposing here's a big bully who beats up a little fellow. And I see that, and I see the injustice in this thing. And that this fellow is just taking advantage of him. All right, I say it's none of my business because my interests aren't involved. Wouldn't this be on the same order as you?
You have to be careful. Now, you're taking an analogy from interpersonal relations and trying to make it apply to international relations, and I think this is always dangerous. Most of the analogies of this sort don't fit because there are so many differences in the situation. But you see, when you intervene as a person, the only thing you risk is you. Your glasses, your teeth, you know, and you have a right to risk yourself. But the President of the United States does not have a right to risk me and my life for his vague and abstract concepts of justice. However, I'd say what I had to say does apply somewhat to the realm of personal morality. Child. there is such a thing as a busybody.
I was thinking, for instance, of some of the stories that have come out from New York where this girl was killed, and a lot of people wouldn't even call the police, come to her aid, and so on, which is happening in citizen situations.
Yeah.
Well, the same thing can happen, I suppose, in a larger sense, and I was wondering where the justifiableness enters into this picture.
Now, well, I just reject the analogy. I will not accept a conclusion drawn from the realm of personal relations for international relations, relations among collectivities. The crucial difference is this, that the interest of an individual is unitary, it's one. And the individual who asserts his interest also bears himself the penalty for the assertion of that interest. In collectivities, there's a fundamental difference. There is no single interest. And the person who is to represent the national interest is representing a whole hodgepodge of interests. And therefore, there is no moral imperative at any time. What we think is a moral imperative really turns out to be, well, when we think we have a moral imperative, that is because we have looked at only one facet of the issue and we've submerged another facet of it.
White.
Yeah, I know. She's looking black. By the way, last night, Laverne Rieke kept saying he was warning you about Paul Hain. What he meant is Mrs. Paul Hain.
I'm just going to ask, I'm not going to ask any questions about the angry questions. I have one question I would like to answer. Your description of collectivities as having no real, moral purposes and they only pursue an interest generally. Fine. Now, what you've got though in the union collectivities is individuals. Many of whom may have different kinds of interests. Many of whom may have moral interests. So that I may be a person who in 1940 felt a real personal interest and sympathy for Jews that Hitler was rounding up, or a real, any kind of situation like this, where you would say that the nations have no business intervening here. So how do you feel about things like the International Brigade? We have Lincoln Brigade, the Spanish Civil War, or a similar brigade now in Vietnam, where individuals who, for instance, are opposed to the Vietnam War on a moral basis, would, on an individual basis, get together. And, well, people are doing this in Vietnam. Some people are going up and giving blood to the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese. Some of the Quakers are doing the kind of thing. They're not really choosing a side, but they're serving in a way that is objective to what this nation's policy there. But they're doing it on their own. What is your reaction to this? And you could do this all over the world. And that would be, I feel that this is my brother here that is being destroyed. He's being destroyed. I'm going over and fighting to me, and then Joe and Sam and so forth agree with me,
we go. Yeah, well, it's not my task to judge these people. That's the first thing I say. It's not my task to judge them. I don't know what their motives are, and I'm not going to pass judgment on their motives. And it is the task of the government to assess their actions and the consequences of their actions and to control them, if necessary, by law. The government may decide that the damage that they do to the cause which the government is prosecuting is insignificant, and therefore it prefers to allow them the freedom to ship medical supplies into North Vietnam, say. Or the government may decide that they are seriously interfering with its efforts to bring that war to its kind of conclusion, and therefore the government can prevent them from doing this. This is a decision that the government will reach on the basis of its information. I don't have that information. I personally respect deeply the motives and the character of these people. I admire them because they are obviously courageous people who are risking their lives for something in which they believe. I think they are, to some extent, misguided. They tend to ignore the complexities of this situation, but I'm not for that reason going to pass judgment on them. The Abraham Lincoln Brigade is treated similarly. It's if people feel that they want to fight, they want to risk, give their lives in defense of somebody somewhere, generally I say this is a person's freedom. He can give his life. He finds like-minded people, they can give their lives. Of course, the government will always reserve the right to prevent people from engaging in what it calls the conduct of foreign policy. And if the government decides that the formation of a volunteer brigade constitutes the conduct of foreign policy, the government can and will intervene to prevent it. Walt?
In what sense was the principle of unconditional surrender in the national interests of the countries?
Yeah. In what sense was the principle of unconditional surrender in the interest of the Allied countries in the Second World War? And my answer is it was not at all in the national interest. It was a tragic betrayal of intelligent diplomacy. We were in effect saying, you, Japan, Italy, Germany, all of you, all of your people, every bit of your nationhood is so evil and corrupt that there is only one term on which we will settle with you. And that is if you grovel in the dust and say, we can do to you anything that we like. That's what unconditional surrender means. Now that was the most self-righteous kind of proclamation. Worse, it prolonged the war. We did not, in fact, impose our own unilateral terms upon Germany, Italy, or Japan. We had no interest in doing so. We couldn't. We didn't want to. We don't want to regulate every detail of Japanese, German, and Italian life. We get over our heads. We can't mess with all of that stuff. Then why did we pretend that we wanted to? We did it, I think, out of a sense of moral superiority, that the Axis evil was an evil so black that right-thinking men cannot tolerate it for a moment. And, well, what we did, we prolonged the war, we sacrificed hundreds of thousands of lives needlessly, we just nipped off in each of these countries those forces which were working toward coup d'etat, or elimination of the militarist, more militaristic, more stubborn, less, more intransigent forces. We just nipped them off. When we said unconditional surrender, we just sort of steeled the resolve of every person who was wavering in Germany, Italy, and Japan. I think it's a beautiful example of how man, in his pursuit of, in his tendency to crusade for righteousness, can eliminate all limitations to war and make war genuinely demonic. And of course, we are still paying the penalty for that. We wiped out Germany in the middle of the continent and then found ourselves faced with another superpower on the eastern end of the continent. And so we had to go back to work and rebuild Germany up as a counter and a buffer to the Soviet Union. Yeah?
Interested in your comment about individual Christians, the moral implications of the individual Christian's involvement in war. You said that he is not to judge whether this war is justifiable or just or not. Coming back to the confession, and when may a Christian involve himself, and wouldn't it be the safe thing to do to follow the pattern of the first three centuries after Christ and simply not participate? In other words, for Christians to be conscientious objectors, is this ultimately the doctrine that you're preaching?
Oh, no, by no means. No, I'm not. In fact, the confessions, we begin with the confessions. If you examine the confessions, they in Article 16 of the Augsburg Confession, they talk about a just war. In the apology, they get into an elaboration of this, and as you search around for an implicit definition of just war, it turns out to be the war that your ruler is fighting. That's what it turns out to be, I think. You examine it. It's very interesting. Apology, Article 16, is fascinating and very relevant. A lot of things have been talked about up here. I think that a good number of us would, you know, you don't have to believe in the apology to the Augsburg Confession, especially in these areas. This isn't dogma, but I think there are a lot of people up here who would be, to that extent, at least non-Lutheran. They don't buy this kind of realpolitik that just glares at you out of Article 16 of the apology. The early Christian conscientious objection is, I think, due to some peculiar factors that I don't want to get into. Paul Sonnek could discuss them more, not much more knowledgeably than I could anyway. But it wasn't just due to a belief that war is evil. It had also to do with the nature of the state as kind of an antichrist and some of the rituals that were associated with being a soldier.
There's one aspect of this thing that is quite frightening, looked at from the standpoint of the Christian, because you very easily get yourself into a position where one type of conduct and morality and principle applies to you when you're an individual. But the moment you become a part of a so-called collectivity, then you're not bound by the same kind of morality or principle, but in fact it becomes not only your privilege, but it becomes your duty to act under an entirely different type of morality or of principle. And this is particularly a problem, it seems to me, in a type of government such as ours. Because at least theoretically, we are a nation in which the individual citizen, as Edgar Carson has pointed out, becomes actually the ruler. And to say that when he takes public office or when he acts as a citizen, as a part of a collectivity, he can't carry his Christian principle and his morality into his decisions and his life and his responsibility. I have a lot of agreement with what you've said, but you're carrying it so far that you actually compel this kind of a division within the individual's body of principle.
Well, I'm going to answer that question by postponing. On Thursday, I want to talk about the United Nations, the responsibility of the United States toward poverty in our world. Question mark. I'm going to try to avoid begging a whole bunch of questions here. In the course of this, I think we will find your dilemma emerging very crucially, and I just know that some of the people who will be here are they're just going to object out of the wellsprings of their being to some of the things I'm going to assert. I'm going to use the principles that I've enunciated this morning, apply them in the very difficult, intricate realm of what you call U.S. aid to the underdeveloped nations of the world. Your problem will come up again, and I think we can discuss it there. I think it is a false dilemma. It's a false dilemma, but we'll see. Huh? It's time to quit. Walt, you get to have the last word as a dogmatician.
I just want to say, could it be said preliminarily that the problem arises because we have identified Christianity with certain types of conduct instead of believing the gospel? And if we could remember that the one thing which characterizes any of us as Christians is the fact that we believe the gospel. And that we're not small
cats. Kill or not
kill. Kill or not kill. Right. Yeah. All the way. What makes a man, Laverne said it last night in his lecture, that what makes it possible for us to live in error is that we are believers of the gospel.
Just to show that Walt is being Lutheran, let me read this little bit from the Apology of the Augsburg Confession and then sit down. The different kinds of public redress are legal decisions, capital punishment, wars, military service. It is manifest how incorrectly many writers have judged concerning these matters, because they were in the error that the gospel is an external, new, and monastic form of government, and did not see that the gospel brings eternal righteousness to hearts, while it outwardly approves the civil state. The gospel is not a new monastic form of government. Well. But if you're mad, stay riled up, because we fight.